Police now say it looks like Lori Dan woke up Friday intent on murder. As early as 7 a.m., she delivered poison-tainted packets of orange drink to several north suburban homes where she'd worked as a babysitter. At 9 o'clock, she showed up for work and tackled her last babysitting job by serving contaminated milk to two children, taking them to a local school, then setting a rubbish fire in the school hallway. Through the morning, another school averted disaster when a janitor found Dan carrying a gasoline can and shooed her away. She took the kids home again, locked them in the basement, and set fire in the home stairwell. While the children escaped through a window, Dan headed for the nearby Hubbard Woods Elementary. Six of the seven people Dan shot Friday are still hospitalized in critical and serious condition. Now that police know what happened, they're trying to figure out why it happened, piecing together stories from people who knew Lori Dan here and in Madison, Wisconsin, and Tucson, Arizona, two recent homes. They say she had a history of making threatening phone calls, charges a federal grand jury has been investigating. Dan's ex-husband claims she once stabbed him with an ice pick. Of course, no one in Winnetka had those clues before Dan started her bizarre crime spree on Friday, and today, neighbors met at a local church trying to pull each other through this tragedy.
It was a nice mass and everything, but it brought back what happened, and you kept thinking of the people, what happened to them, and it just hurts.
School used to be pretty safe, or so they thought. And it puts a whole new light on things now.
Judy Kavanaugh brought her three children to special counseling services offered this morning by her church. She picked up a handout explaining the signs of trauma and offering tips on how to help children who may not be able to fully explain their feelings. Irene Kerr, who lives across the street from Hubbard Woods School, has already been trying to do that, talking at length with her six-year-old daughter and her friends.
They've asked, how are we sure that she's dead? And when somebody is crazy, when do they start being crazy? How can you tell that they're crazy so that you can identify? They were very surprised to see her picture and think that she looked nice. And for my family, the most difficult part of it is that she was a babysitter. And we always have babysitters. And the idea that a babysitter could be that kind of a person is very traumatic to my children. Yeah, look, you got it.
Kerr spent most of the day today playing with her two children in the Hubbard Woods School playground. She's been watching other families drive by, slow, and even park to look in the windows. That, like the game she's playing on the playground, seemed therapeutic to Kerr, a way to show kids that life goes on.
We can't dwell on it constantly. We just have to go forward. We just have to keep, riding our bikes and playing in the neighborhood, and we'll do what we've always done, drink coffee on the street corner on Saturday mornings, which we did yesterday, like we do every Saturday morning.
Still, Kerr expects some changes in this quiet, affluent neighborhood. She's sure schools and homes will be locked more carefully, and she expects a push for gun control laws. There will be no classes tomorrow for the students at Hubbard Woods Elementary. Instead, they'll report to school in the morning for a memorial service for their slain classmate. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago. An alternate tag is to read the name of the child who was slain, and I'm going to do that. There will be no classes tomorrow for the students at Hubbard Woods Elementary. Instead, they'll report to school in the morning for a memorial service for their slain classmate, second grader Nicholas Corwin. For National Public Radio, I'm Arch Halperin in Chicago. Here's the Morning Edition News Spot, the intro. Later this morning, students from Hubbard Woods Elementary in Chicago's north suburb of Winnetka will gather for a funeral service for 8-year-old Nicholas Corwin, killed at the school in a bizarre shooting spree on Friday. As Marge Halperin reports, many of the families in this quiet neighborhood spent their weekend mourning and trying to figure out why. At a special service yesterday, one neighborhood church tried to help families cope with the tragedy. Mass was followed up with group counseling for children and their parents. Judy Kavanaugh brought her three children.
I think, they could associate with other kids who maybe had the same thoughts, same feelings, find out that whatever they were thinking or feeling wasn't just theirs.
Some children are having trouble sleeping. Others are grappling with a first-time fear in what has always been a very quiet, secure neighborhood. Still others are having trouble understanding why 30-year-old Lori Dan was able to open fire on a second-grade classroom.
Well, you're feeling pretty guilty because we're the oldest ones at this school and we should have done something.
fifth grader Katie Simpson and her classmates will continue sharing their feelings and thoughts about Friday's tragedy when they return to school this afternoon for a special memorial service. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago. There will be no classes this morning for students at Hubbard Woods Elementary in the Chicago suburb of Winnetka. School ended there Friday when 30-year-old Lori Dan opened fire on a second-grade classroom, killing one child and injuring five others. She also shot a 20-year-old neighbor of the school before killing herself. Today, students and their parents and teachers are trying to cope with the tragedy, continuing the emotional healing that began over the weekend, Marge Halperin reports. As news filtered into police of poison-tainted snacks Dan left at area homes before the shooting and of her history of making threatening phone calls, families in the wealthy suburb of Winnetka gathered in church yesterday trying to understand what led Dan to Friday's bizarre events.
Crazy and
yeah,
maybe like drunk or something.
I don't think drunk because she poisoned people too.
Yeah.
So
I think maybe she was on... I think someone said she was on drugs, but I'm not really sure. But
I don't think so. I think she was just crazy.
Calling Lori Dan crazy is one way these children found to once again feel safe.
Something like this wouldn't happen in this kind of neighborhood. But she was mentally ill, and she called her parents up, and she said, I did something very bad, and she killed herself. So I thought she was probably a nice girl, but she did something bad.
10-year-old Justin Sinclair lives down the block from Hubbard Woods Elementary, and yesterday he attended a special counseling program at his church. Today he's likely to attend the school's memorial service for second grader Nicholas Corwin, killed Friday in his second grade classroom. But the children's parents know it'll take more than a few talks or services to calm young minds. Irene Kerr lives across the street from the school and has been spending a lot of time playing there with her children, who are 6 and 3.
People come by day and night since it's happened to look in the classroom. Children come, sometimes people, obviously parents with their children are coming. Sometimes they stop their cars, sometimes they just drive by and they're obviously talking all about it. I think it's therapeutic for everyone to talk about it and to visit the scene. I think it'll be hard for kids to come back to school, and I think the more the parents bring them around when the school's not in session and talk about it, I think the better.
But Kerr admits this is the kind of trauma that will not easily go away. She expects to be discussing it for quite some time with her own children. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago. The host intro. 60 years ago, two Irish theater mavericks struck out on their own to stir up competition for Ireland's national theater company, the venerable Abbey Theater. The founders of the Gate Theater met their goal and ended up establishing their own Irish institution. Audiences at this week's New York Theater Festival are getting a sample of the Gate at its best, which, as Marge Halperin reports, means creative theater.
Thus we cleared these difficult straits, my bicycle and I, together. But a little further on, I heard myself hailed. I raised my head and saw a policeman.
What are you doing there?
He said. I'm used to that question. I understood it immediately. Resting, I said.
Resting,
he said. Resting, I said.
Will you answer my question?
He cried. So it always is when I'm reduced to confabulation. I honestly believe I have answered the question I am asked, and in reality, I do nothing of the kind.
The Gate's New York selections include Barry McGovern's one-man show, I'll Go On, adapted from 3 Beckett novels. It's a work that clearly points out the difference between the Gate and the Abbey, known as the Sodom and Begorra of Irish theater. The Gate has always taken on a mix of risky plays and international works to offset the Abbey's traditional Irish classics. Over the years, the line between the two theaters has blurred a bit, but the work at the Gate is always distinctive in the tradition of its founders, Michael McLeamore and Hilton Edwards. These two men were the Gate Theater from the time they opened the doors in 1928 until they lost the energy to keep it up in the 1970s. McLeamore and Edwards shared all aspects of a production, alternately serving as director, producer, costume designer, actors, and writers. To see how completely they controlled the Gate, one needs only to rifle through a production book filed away as part of an extensive collection of Gate papers at the Northwestern University Library in Evanston, Illinois.
These are the plays which Edwards took and then reworked for the stage. There you see a typical page where he has crossed out, a whole lot of the dialogue he doesn't want to use, in various places, made notes, changed the dialogue.
Here's a place where he tore apart a copy of Lady Windermere's Fan, and then he wrote in all the entrances and exits and made a actual prompt book out of it. And there is a program and...
So but this they, is the whole process you can trace from
yes.
some raw material play that someone else wrote to what they wanted
to
on stage.
To what they wanted to do on stage.
Tina Howe and Russell Malone have spent 2 years organizing the Gate Papers, unfolding the history of a theater that took its direction from its two strong leaders. McLeamore and Edwards put their stamp on the Gate not only by seeing to so many of the details themselves, but by choosing actors for each individual play, not relying on a familiar company, and by calling in designers, sometimes even artists, to create a set that complemented their independent style.
They always talked about the expressionist kind of theater, and it was something that was coming out of Europe at that time in the 20s, related also to, I suppose, the German expressionism. But it was an attempt to take the theater out of sort of a Victorian, well, if we're going to do a parlor scene, it has to have a couch and a table and a chair and everything else, and make it a much more symbolic kind of theater, where the setting itself was very, very dramatic, but it wasn't necessarily tied exactly to what the play was about. The setting itself could have some symbolic meaning that overshadowed the play.
Russell Malone says that look and feel made the work of the Gate quite demanding. McLeamore and Edwards, while talented in nearly all areas of the theater, were poor businessmen. And when the Gate closed down in the late 1970s, they left behind a theater and organization in need of repair. The Gate was salvaged in 1983 by artistic director Michael Colgan, whom Russell Malone credits with bringing the Gate into its golden years.
He has extraordinary vision for what the theater can do. And he's a man who gets things done. And if you can't do them the way he wants them done, you'll have to find work elsewhere. And thank you very much. We have a job to do. And the Arts Council has come back with very strong support. So things are going very, very well at the present time.
Under Michael Colgan's leadership, the theater that gave such actors as Orson Welles, Geraldine Fitzgerald, James Mason, and Carol O'Connor their start is once again asserting itself. The New York production of I'll Go On is typical of Colgan's attempt to revive the best of The Gate. It's an original work which actor Barry McGovern helped adapt. Like The Gate productions of old, this show has a striking set. A sparse stage is blocked into a triangle, with two neon-framed, marbleized walls coming to a corner in the center. For the first act, a wooden sawhorse serves as a bench, bicycle, and dead dog. In the second, the only prop is a sarcophagus, upon which McGovern either lies or sits, waiting for death. It's the kind of production McLeamore and Edwards would have loved.
I shall soon be quite dead at last, in spite of all. Perhaps next month. Then it'll be the month of April, or of May, for the year is still young, a thousand little signs tell me so. Perhaps I am wrong. Perhaps I shall survive St. John the Baptist's day, and even the 14th of July, Festival of Freedom. Indeed, I would not put it past me to pant on to the Transfiguration, not to speak of the Assumption. I could die today, if I wished, merely by making a little effort. But it's just as well to let myself die quietly, without rushing things.
Barry McGovern's play I'll Go On and the Gate's other New York production, an internationally acclaimed staging of Juno and the Paycock, are shows that might well have been staged at the Abbey Theater, though not with the Gate style. Choosing these plays has drawn some criticism that the Gate is becoming too safe, a charge actor McGovern vigorously denies.
There are some people who might say that the Gate is being safe, but they do an awful lot of shows. I mean, they've just, at the moment, as I speak, they are doing Oscar Wilde's Salome, which is not a great play on the page, and is a very daring choice. And in fact, the reason that they're doing Salome, as indeed they're doing Peer Gynt by Ibsen later on in the year, is because both these plays were put on in the first season in 1928. The problem with the Gate is it can't take enough chances. They need to have a huge percentage of bums on seats, if I may use that sort of well-worn phrase now. There's no point in putting on shows that aren't going to bring people in, because you're wasting your time.
With an eye toward keeping those bums on its theater seats, the Gate seems to have found its niche, drawing a strong audience for the best of Ireland's new works and fresh versions of the classics. For National Public Radio, this is Marge Halperin reporting. Host intro. It's the height of the wedding season, but there are far fewer weddings in Illinois this summer than in summers past. The reason? A controversial law, effective January 1st, requiring couples to take an AIDS test before they can get a marriage license. As Marge Halpin reports, that law has prompted thousands of Illinois couples to get married out of state. What might seem to be a good way to ferret out new AIDS cases has turned out to be a prime way to push bridal couples out of state, with one in four couples now opting to get married in neighboring Indiana, Iowa, Kentucky, or Wisconsin. This summer's wedding march might be changed to "There Goes the Bride." Even those who, like Jeanette Pantoja, choose to have their weddings in Illinois will still complain about the AIDS test.
I don't think it was fair. I don't have AIDS, and for me to spend that much money and not to have it, and I think it was a waste of time and money.
So you think maybe if it was an optional test, you would like that as a law better?
Well, yeah. And then if you didn't have it, maybe a reimbursement or something.
State lawmakers who voted for the AIDS test requirement say it serves both to target new AIDS cases and to educate the public about the disease's rapid spread to all segments of the population. However, that's not necessarily what the law has accomplished, according to Dr. Renslow Shearer, former chairman of the Illinois AIDS Council, a study group commissioned by the governor. That group predicted AIDS testing for engaged couples would be a waste of money. After nearly 6 months, Shearer says his prediction has come true, with some 25,000 tests turning up only six cases of AIDS.
This is like voodoo public health. It's creating the impression that something is being done, where we know that some 50 to 60,000 people carry the virus in Illinois. Another half a million are at significant risk, are homosexually active men or actively using intravenous drugs, or are their immediate heterosexual partners. Those are the people we would like to get that counseling to most urgently, and yet here we are testing this other group of people.
Many in that group just refuse to be tested.
Need you both to raise your right hands, please. Need you to swear everything on here is true and correct to the best of your knowledge, and that you're free to marry under the laws of the state of Wisconsin. Is that true?
Yes, ma'am. Yes.
Many of them end up in the border town of Kenosha, Wisconsin, enthusiastically welcomed by Kenosha County Clerk Nancy Principe and her record books.
This is how we keep track of who's getting married. This is for Judge Schrader on Saturday. Let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
And you have them scheduled every 5 minutes through the whole morning.
Right.
And the groom, if you'd sign, please, sir, right here. Sir, right there, your name right there.
Up in
sir.
Judge Gerald Breitenbach's courtroom, weddings are sandwiched in between more mundane proceedings. On this day, a lengthy jury selection was broken up by three Illinois weddings. The judge says he's doing so many weddings lately that they, too, are beginning to sound routine.
Dear family and friends of Stefan and Grazino, we are gathered here today to join in matrimony this man and this woman. Matrimony.
Last week, I think I did about 20 weddings. The weekend before, I had, on a Saturday morning, I think I had 18 weddings. So.
How does that compare to maybe a year ago?
Two or three a year ago.
Dear family and friends of Charles and Angel, we are gathered here today to join in matrimony this man and this woman.
I like doing the weddings. It's that and adoptions and so forth are part of the nice part of being a judge. But it's getting a little tiring at the moment, so I don't know how long we'll last here in Wisconsin. I wish they'd change the Illinois law.
Dear family and friends of Nelson and Loida, we are gathered here today to join in matrimony.
All of these weddings may be tiring for the judge and somewhat of a letdown for the couple, but it's great for the city of Kenosha. Nancy Principe welcomes Illinois couples as if she were an offshoot of the Tourism Bureau.
When they do come in, they want to know about Kenosha. What does Kenosha have to offer? What can you do in Kenosha? Where can we stay in Kenosha? So I direct them to restaurants. I direct them to different hotels. I've taken an opportunity and worked with it. I've had fun with it. I met a lot of people, and plus, we're making money, too, at the same time, which never hurts.
Acting on that philosophy, Principe raised her marriage license fee just a few weeks after Illinois' AIDS test requirement became law. She now gets $50 cash from each Illinois couple, up from the old fee of $40. That means that since January 1st, Principe's taken in over $30,000, and most of that money came from Illinois couples, who stream through her office every day full of complaints about Illinois' AIDS test.
We prefer to come down here because there's no hassle and it's wide open, and that's because you're
private into people's private life when you start doing things like that, and I think it's wrong.
I've been a widow, well, probably a year and a half, and I was with my husband till the end. How would I be going out and catching anything? You know, it's almost insulting my integrity.
It's unnecessary. It's expensive, and it's unnecessary.
The $160, that's no way to start. It's just too much.
I know she's healthy, you know. If I thought otherwise, I wouldn't be marrying her.
That resentment is costing Illinois more than goodwill. The state's figures show that by the end of May, even before the summer rush, about 27,000 couples had applied for marriage licenses in Illinois, down more than 22% from this time last year. At $15 a license, county governments have already lost more than $100,000. Add to that the estimated $400,000 couples have paid for AIDS tests, and the Illinois AIDS Council's Dr. Scherr says the requirement becomes a misallocation of public health dollars.
The kinds of things that could be done with that money would include getting specific counseling and testing to people at the highest risk, making condoms widely available, trying to reach the 80,000 intravenous drug users in our state. I think that's the greatest failure of the General Assembly has been to commit the resources needed for general AIDS education and AIDS education for specific groups at risk, as well as to provide compassionate services for people who are affected.
Still, state lawmakers remain unconvinced. Last month, they rejected several attempts to repeal the AIDS test requirement, deciding to give the law a full year for a more thorough evaluation. That means Illinois couples will be crossing the border for another 6 months.
Now, therefore, by virtue of the authority vested in me by the state of Wisconsin and in the presence of these witnesses, I do declare that you are husband and wife. You may kiss the bride. Congratulations to both of you. Many years ahead.
For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago. Japan, a country that continually struggles with the modernization of old world tradition, is now putting a new face on the ancient art of comic storytelling, known as Rakugo. Rakugo has been slowly evolving in recent years to keep up with Japan's television generation. Now it's taking a big step into the modern world with never before heard English translations. As Marge Halperin reports, it's not clear whether that's a step in the right direction. And a pronouncer for you, Rakugo is said with equal emphasis on all three syllables. In its traditional form, now over 300 years old, Rakugo was a mix of restrained narration and creative use of the subtleties of the Japanese language. The Rakugoka would spin clever, often bawdy stories, or as some translate the word, stories with punchlines. But today, the art has taken a Western twist. The music storyteller Shizaku Katsura used to open performances over the weekend in San Francisco and in Chicago gave a tip-off to the modernized version of Rakugo that followed. In keeping with ancient tradition, Shizaku sat in the middle of a nearly bare stage, dressed in a kimono and perched on a thick cushion, or zabutan. He began not with a traditional story, but with a quick explanation of his art for the uninitiated in his American audience.
It looks like I have nothing. I have nothing, no face makeup, no costume, no scenery in the background. It looks like I have nothing, but I have one thing. One special thing, that is your imagination. Your imagination, my story and my action, and your imagination, that is my Rakugo, okay? Okay? When I say, what high mountain this is, when I say that, you must imagine high mountain there, okay?
To feed his audience's imagination, Shizaku uses the finer points of the art, gestures and facial expressions that carry the story from one character to the next. He learned his technique in a 3-year live-in apprenticeship with a master, but Shizaku has given the art a flair all his own, mugging for the crowd and using wildly exaggerated motions. He describes his style with the help of an interpreter.
Cushion and zabuton. Zabuton cushion.
The ordinary Rakugo performer is sitting quietly on the cushion, but he's moving everywhere all the time. But he never leaves the cushion, he's always on top of it.
Shizaku's exaggerations seem to make the performance more palatable for American audiences, but not for those familiar with the traditional art. William Sibley is chairman of the University of Chicago's East Asian Languages and Civilizations Department. While he says that Shizaku is a popular Rakugo star on TV in Japan, Sibley finds his version of Rakugo strikingly different from that of traditional performers.
the narrator does not become a street vendor or an old peasant woman or a geisha or whatever the character in the story is. He suggests it by a slight inflection, a raised eyebrow here, a thump of the fan on the mats there. He never loses his own voice. I think that's probably important. There's this mingling of the voice and the look of the narrator with the voices and the looks of the characters.
That difference does not seem to trouble Shigaku, who not only performs on many Japanese TV shows, but is also a familiar face on Japanese advertisements. He says his goal, both in Japan and in his unique English performances, is not necessarily to build on the old world tradition.
But, yes, but...
He says that his greatest purpose is not so much to teach about Japan as for that particular audience in that particular occasion to make people laugh and to become friends with them.
For you, making the audience laugh is what makes Rakugo work?
Hmm?
It doesn't work if the audience, if you don't get their sense of humor or vice versa.
In his career, he's never had the experience of the audience not laughing, so...
Shigaku does make his audiences laugh. In the States, he does it with a liberal sprinkling of Americanisms, which spice up translated Japanese tales. One of the show's biggest laughs comes in the story of a noodle soup or udon vendor.
Come closer to me, huh? Here you go. No, too hot, too hot. Sorry, sorry. No wonder. It's boiling hot water for my udon. It's a boiling hot water for my udon. Be patient, be patient. No pain, no gain.
Shigaku doesn't, however, advocate the wanton use of American slang in what ultimately remains a Japanese art form. Lapsing into Japanese, he tells how he draws the line.
So that's an important point that I think. So it's ne.
That's a very important point that you've brought up there, because he thinks that if it's too colloquial, it's not good.
So it's ne. Japanese say English is okay, I think. Ne?
He says keeping that sort of Japanese English quality in the story is important. That's right. He doesn't want to refine it too much.
And Shigaku's English shows do carry a strong Japanese flavor, as in this story of a man who falls from atop a high pagoda to friends holding a blanket below.
Fortunately, the man hit the target dead center. But unfortunately, the four person held the clothes too tightly. Held the clothes too tightly. So the man bounced up again into the air and landed in the same place on the top of the pagoda.
It's with that mix of the old and the new that Shigaku and other popular TV rakugoka are bringing the art of storytelling into the 20th century. Purists may say they're leaving its best qualities behind, but Shigaku isn't looking back. He hopes to win a new country of fans next month as he performs his English rakugo in Australia for the first time. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago. Host intro. In Chicago Today, charges that the FBI spied on political activists working against the government's policy in Central America. As Marge Halperin reports, these are charges that would only stick in Chicago. And this story is embargoed until after 9 a.m. July 7th. Story in 3, 2, 1. There is no national law on the books, no court precedent banning the FBI from spying on Americans who form political action groups. However, in Chicago, the FBI has agreed not to interfere with the activities of political groups, an agreement reached after a 14-year court battle over the tactics used during the 1960s by the FBI in conjunction with the Chicago police unit known as the Red Squad. Citing that unique Chicago agreement, the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador, CISPIS, is charging the FBI with illegally spying on its activities in Chicago between 1981 and 85, and possibly longer, during a time when, according to FBI documents, agents used informants to gather information on CISPIS as part of what was labeled a terrorism investigation. CISPIS member Sheila Brady says, however, that her group did nothing that could be classified as terrorism.
We were raising money for humanitarian aid. We had forums. We went door to door with information. We put up posters. We did all the things that Americans are allowed to do, practice all of the legal rights that we have under the Constitution.
Apparently, the FBI didn't find evidence of terrorism, since no Chicago CISPIS members have been charged with illegal activities of any kind. The FBI has no comment on the CISPIS suit, except to say that results of an internal investigation into the matter should be reported to Congress by the end of this summer. It has been reported that that investigation includes a call for disciplinary action against several FBI employees in Washington and elsewhere. CISPIS attorney Richard Gutman expects the investigation to reveal that the FBI infiltrated CISPIS to gather information on members' activities. It's a tactic Gutman says was common before the Chicago court ban on political spying.
What happened in the past, and I think this has to be viewed in its historical context, I mean, in the past, the FBI gathered information on a vast number of lawful political groups and used information to disrupt and destroy them. Once an agency of the government infiltrates a group, you can find all kinds of information that can be used to disrupt a group, because most groups have some internal dissent, and there are various ways you can provoke that dissent and get groups fighting with each other.
If Gutman wins this lawsuit against the FBI, all of the CISPIS files found to have been gathered illegally will be erased from government records, and the FBI could have to pay compensatory damages. The more lucrative punitive damages aren't allowed in this type of case, but Gutman stresses CISPIS isn't filing this suit to make money.
We're doing it because if they can do it to CISPIS, they can do it to anyone. And it even went beyond CISPIS. I mean, they started spying on CISPIS, and then they started gathering intelligence on what they said were groups that simply were connected with CISPIS in some fashion. This kind of activity has to be stopped because it just expands and expands, and the targets expand. And in one day, like Watergate, you have burglaries of the Democratic Party.
Gutman is hoping to draw up a list of other groups affected by the CISPIS investigation as he gains access to more FBI files in the process of litigating this suit. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago. Here's an alternative graph in case the FBI does have a comment on the day that you're ready to air this. Pick this up right after the first actuality, the woman listing her activities out cue under the Constitution. Apparently, the FBI didn't find evidence of terrorism, since no Chicago CISPIS members have been charged with illegal activities of any kind. Some details of the FBI's activities will be revealed later this summer when Director William Sessions briefs Congress on his own staff investigation into the case. It's been reported that that investigation includes a call for disciplinary action against several FBI employees in Washington and elsewhere. CISPIS attorney Richard Gutman expects the investigation to reveal that the FBI infiltrated CISPIS to gather information on members' activities. It's a tactic Gutman says was common before the Chicago court ban on political spying.
Nearly 200 sculptors will exhibit their work this weekend in Loveland, Colorado. Loveland, population 35,000, is a major sculpture center and has more than 30 artists living near the town's two foundries. According to local residents, Loveland's artists make more large monuments each year than do sculptors in any other community in the United States. As Marge Halperin reports, the sculptors have formed an influential hub in this town.
There are plenty of places around the country that can boast of resident artists. What makes Loveland special is not just the fact that there are so many sculptors, all working in similar realist styles, but that they've formed a bond that makes theirs a close-knit, supportive community. Some work on their own ranches, some in restored churches, but most of the sculptors in Loveland have set up their studios downtown on a strip that has otherwise fallen on hard times, with as many pawn shops and thrift stores as studios. Here, the sculptors are pulled together by a man who serves as unofficial mayor of Loveland's sculptor community, George Lundeen. Lundeen came to town in 1976 to use the local foundry, and he never left. In Loveland, Lundeen finds an energy level that keeps him going even through the roughest of times.
Once in a while, you'll be down, and all you have to do is go get a cup of coffee over at the foundry, and And you see how excited another sculptor is on the production of his first piece out of the mold. And it makes you want to get up the next morning and get in there yourself and have that same kind of joy and satisfaction with the work that you're doing.
It's a friendly group. Sculptors here aren't afraid to ask for or to offer help. Where else, Lundeen asks, can a harried sculptor find such a reliable, talented crew to bring in a piece on deadline?
It happened 4 or 5 years ago with a very good friend of mine named Thomas Schomburg, who did the piece of bronze of Sylvester Stallone for Rocky III. Tom was far behind. He called up a friend of mine and myself, and in a week we had taken Tom's small model and virtually modeled the whole thing up ready for mold.
Neighbors are also quick with much-needed advice and even criticism. There's plenty of evidence of that cooperative relationship to be found in a visit to Danny Haskew's studio.
This piece was helped. Fritz White, I know, gave me a hand in just getting a lot of dramatic action in that piece. I know George helped me with the eyes on a lady. It was a lady, a portrait of a lady with a robe. That training has helped me with the eyes on other little portraits. In fact, I have this piece right here in the middle that I've just, it's getting close to completion, and I thought the other day about getting George over here just to give me a critique of it, you know.
And now he's here.
Yeah. Yeah, George, what do you think?
George Lundeen takes a slow walk around the tabletop sculpture of a farmer and his wife before offering tips on how to complete the figure's hands. On other visits, they'll exchange tips on local mold makers and other artisans available as support crews to help the sculptors. Or, Haskew says, they'll gossip about the business.
You find out which shows are good, how to go about entering a show, how to present your work, how to just present yourself, you know, how to sell yourself as well as your work. And, of course, just office, just general bookkeeping, how to keep track of where pieces are in galleries. And, you know, there's a lot of good ideas.
One good idea that got around town fast was the scoop on what these sculptors call the best plastiline clay in the world. It's made by resident photographer Fabrice Deligowski, and it's the pride of Loveland.
Somebody just came up with a name for it today, a fellow that's working, another sculptor that's working with Mark Lundeen. His name is Victor Issa, and he came up with the name of the Master's Choice. And I said, well, it looked good on a, you know, coffee can. It might look good on a box of clay.
That's just one of many special services available for Loveland sculptors. The town also boasts a small army of support workers, staffing the two local foundries and providing other artists supplies. That's probably the main reason the sculptors enjoy an unusually positive relationship with the rest of Loveland. An industrial and corporate center, Loveland has come to appreciate its artists, not just for the jobs they're creating, but also for their art. Often an artist's first piece is sold in town, funding reproductions which are sold around the country. Loveland is littered with sculpture. Fritz White's Iron Shirt, two Indians doing battle, is poised in front of Taco John's. Several other pieces grace the Civic Center, and most of Loveland's corporate buildings commissioned their own works. But the place to view the cream of the local crop is the town sculpture garden. Out past Loveland's fast food strip, more than a dozen sculptures are lined up along a marsh guarded by chirping birds. George Lundeen says each sculpture is a monument to the artists who are putting Loveland on the map.
And this one?
The two sheep. The two sheep is one of my favorites because this was the first piece ever done by a lady named Mary Zimmerman. And Mary Zimmerman was the lady who originally started doing castings here in Loveland for the foundry. Her husband was Bob Zimmerman, who started the foundry as an industrial foundry. And then hard times hit the foundry business and Bob went bankrupt. And Mary Zimmerman then kept the foundry open late at night when the bank didn't know they were open and did bronze castings for sculptors and actually got them out of bankruptcy.
From there, Loveland has grown into a mecca for sculptors. They come from around the U.S. and even from Canada to finish prized pieces at the local foundries. After a few visits, many decide to stay. In fact, it's a good bet that once this weekend show is over, Loveland will have a few new downtown studios. For National Public Radio, this is Marge Halperin reporting.
Loveland, Colorado's fifth annual sculpture sale takes place this weekend.
Host intro. Chicago, historically a center for architectural innovation, has taken another bold step, approving a downtown library building that strikes out in a new direction. At 10 stories and 500,000 square feet, it's the largest municipal library to be built in the United States, and the nationwide juried design competition has attracted a lot of attention. But as Marge Halpern reports, critics say the direction this strikingly classical building is taking may be backwards. Chicago's Loop is filled with the trademarks of the city's rich architectural tradition. The ornamentation of Louis Sullivan, the functional office buildings of the Chicago School, the glass and steel of Mies van der Rohe. The city's new library, to break ground this fall, draws on all of those styles. The exterior is neoclassical. The rear facade is glass. The other three sides are stately rose granite, marked with five-story arched windows and topped with a roof that's ornamented with leaves and owls. The entryway gives a view of multiple lobbies, and most of the 10 floors are designed as flexible open space to adapt to the library's future needs. The top floor sports a winter garden. It all adds up to a building that most people, when they first see it, instantly say looks like a library. That's one of the main reasons this design was selected, according to the chairman of the 11-member jury, Norman Ross.
I think people feel comfortable in this building. I don't know if you read Bill Granger's article in the Sunday Chicago Tribune, in which he talked about how a library felt to him when he first went to the library and entered the priesthood of literacy when he was a boy. It was a holy place for him to go there. And I think people will have that sense of awe in this library.
The fact that this building is so easily identified as a library can be a drawback as well as an asset. Stanley Tigerman, director of the School of Architecture at the University of Illinois at Chicago, says a building that looks to the past for verification can be denying architecture's future.
Yes, it does look like a library. So bloody what? Do you always have to look back to earlier libraries to get a library? I mean, the question is there not a new way in which a library can take the aspirations of the day, or the disgruntlements of the day, if you like, to find out of it all a new civic monumentality, and without which you're continuously bound to reiteration. It's like monks chanting five times a day the same thing.
The man who designed the new library is Thomas Beebe, a partner in the Chicago firm of Hammond, Beebe & Babka, as well as dean of the Yale University School of Architecture. He says he's tried to interpret the building's classical roots in a subtle, modern form, making them strengths, not weaknesses.
When you build in the city, you have a responsibility to maintain the past, in the sense that you don't make buildings that will confront or destroy the environments around them. You don't attempt to upstage or make the buildings around you look meaningless or bad. On the one hand, there's a way you can extend the traditions you find and to carry them into the future in a responsible way. When you're building the city, you have an obligation to the city as a whole.
And contextually, this design is well conceived. It meshes with the historical office buildings nearby, as well as with the rest of the State Street shopping strip on which it sits. Jury Chairman Norman Ross points out the design also ties together several elements of the Loop, hearkening to the current Library Cultural Center several blocks away.
They both have the tall windows. They both have large rooms inside. Where people can read and read in comfort. It relates back in size and the squareness and the use of exterior materials to this building.
Ross is quick to add, though, that this choice doesn't mean Chicago is turning its back on its architectural heritage.
I don't think that it's an either-or situation as far as the end of a tradition of Miesian-type buildings in Chicago and a irrevocable return just to neo-romantic buildings. We'll end up by having lots of both in the future and should have in the future.
But for now, Chicago is casting its lot with a classical design, and that decision is sure to have an impact on architecture around the country, perhaps internationally, as other architects absorb Chicago's latest statement. Thomas Beebe says he expects his library to have influence over other buildings because of Chicago's role as a major architectural center. But Stanley Tigerman predicts it won't spark a series of copycat classics.
Chicago no longer is representative of an overwhelming, overriding single viewpoint. It is like the rest of the United States, not Europe, but the United States, searching for an indigenous American architecture. So abstraction and representation still are battling for dominance.
Chicago's new Harold Washington Library may or may not be a design for the 21st century, but it certainly has re-energized debate over what our architectural future might be, and that in itself is a major contribution. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago. Chicago Wildflowers host intro. It's an idyllic scene. Wildflowers sway gently in the breeze to the rhythm of chirping birds and insects. An occasional visitor cuts through the gravel path, stopping to take in a view of the garden and its adjoining fountain. This isn't a country scene, but a section of Grant Park along Chicago's lakefront, just a few blocks from the busy loop. As Marge Halperin reports, it's also the focus of a raging controversy. The Chicago Wildflower Works is what artist Chapman Kelly likes to call a work in progress, commissioned by the Chicago Park District 4 years ago. It's a landscape diptych, two side-by-side ellipses the size of football fields turned into wildflower gardens. Kelly, a painter, moved here from Dallas to work in this new medium, and he's done what he set out to do. The garden really does look natural, but not all Chicagoans are pleased.
It needs to come down. I think it needs to come down. I really do. It looks like a bunch of weeds now. But when they first put it up, it was real pretty, very pretty. It's not as pretty as it was when they first put it up.
That kind of comment from visitors to the garden prompted the Chicago Park District to order a study of how the wildflowers might be tamed to make them more consistent with the well-groomed gardens throughout the rest of the park. But that plan sparked a new controversy, and lovers of the wildflowers launched a petition drive, collecting some 5,000 signatures from such visitors as David Dishnow, who says the city officials don't understand the artistic design of the garden.
The big stink is about the plants drying up and their stalks remain, but that's all part of the whole cycle of life and death, and you don't get to see that in the city very often, to see nature in its full cycle.
That's part of the intent of artist Chapman Kelly, but he's now convinced the battle has grown beyond the level of artistic interpretation to a question of First Amendment rights. Kelly's permit to work in the park expired Sunday. While the park district is allowing him to continue to maintain the garden during negotiations over its future, Kelly bristles at the suggestion that someone else may eventually tend to his flowers. He compares these gardens to other publicly commissioned artwork.
If they can be changed in content by public officials, that's just the first step toward the ultimate sort of censorship, which results in book burning and people being shoved into ovens. Censorship is an insidious thing that has to be resisted in all of the arts.
Surprisingly, the man who's battling Kelly is also an artist. Park District Commissioner Walter Netsch has his own showing of watercolors this week at a Chicago gallery, but he insists this is not an issue of artists' rights. Netsch says his responsibility is to maintain the park to serve the entire city, and he doesn't think Kelly's garden is accomplishing that goal.
Anyone who has a permit to work on a piece of Park District property certainly has to agree to and work with the rules of the owner. And to assume that he and he alone should have the final say on everything forever for 3.5 acres of the Grant Park City of Chicago is something that I must admit I don't really see clear to do.
That's why Netsch has asked a panel of horticulturists to study the garden through this summer. They'll make recommendations on ways to make it more palatable for next year. To Chapman Kelly, that's the same as asking another artist to paint on his canvas, and he's hired a lawyer to challenge the plan in court. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago.